Yeah, we are in the beginning of the Book of Shmos, of course, and the Book of Shmos has three fundamental themes. There are three basic stories in the Book of Shmos. There is the story of the exodus of Egypt, from Egypt, Yetzias Mitzrayim. There is the story of Matan Torah. And there is the story of the building of the Mishkan, which is God putting His divine presence within us. And those are three formative experiences for the entire Jewish nation. Once in a while, there's a backtracking, like the sin of the golden calf, which just comes after the giving of the Torah. But in terms of the movement forward, as we say in Israel, Kadima, marching forward, we have Yetzias Mitzrayim, we have Matan Torah, and we have Hakamas HaMishkan. And the Sifrei Chassidus say that this is really the trajectory of a person's spiritual life. I mentioned, just repeat something I said over Shabbos. Each person has to identify their inner Mitzrayim. Remember the word Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is Egypt. But Mitzrayim also means limitation, constriction. And the concept of Yetzias Mitzrayim, leaving Mitzrayim, means that God puts into the world the capacity to liberate myself from those factors within my personality that block me and constrict me and choke me and prevent me from connecting to God. That could be anything. That could be arrogance, that could be selfishness, that could be depression. Whatever those factors are, that is our inner Mitzrayim. And Yetzias Mitzrayim is the ability to be liberated from our Mitzrayim. Again, let me just repeat this idea, because the reason why I need to qualify it a little bit is that there's a popular statement in secular and reform and other movements that say Yetzias Mitzrayim is a myth and it is only a metaphor. And you might be thinking, hey, aren't I saying the same thing? It's not the same thing, because it is 100% the case that Yetzias Mitzrayim, as far as we believing Jews believe, is an actual historical event. The Jews were slaves in Egypt. The Jews were persecuted. The Jews were liberated by 10 plagues and the splitting of the Red Sea. We are not saying it is a metaphor and it is a mashal. It is a historical fact. But it is true that historical facts themselves are metaphors for higher spiritual reality. So instead of saying the metaphor replaces the history, which is against the Torah, what you can say is historical processes themselves are metaphors for higher spiritual truths, and that is absolutely a valid way of looking at the Torah, because every single event is symbolic of a higher and a deeper and a more eternal meaning. In fact, the way the Beis Halevi put it, he said the following, and this statement may sound a little incomprehensible at first. We don't celebrate Pesach because the Jews were taken out of Egypt. Rather, the Jews were taken out of Egypt because it was Pesach. What does that mean? If you looked at, let's say, Pesach as simply commemorating a historical event, then obviously the history precedes the holiday, meaning we celebrate Pesach because we were taken out of Egypt. You couldn't say it the other way. You couldn't say we were taken out of Egypt because it was Pesach. There is no Pesach until we're taken out of Egypt. But if you understand that historical events are simply metaphors for spiritual powers that become manifest in the universe, then it's the other way around. Even before we were taken out of Egypt, God built into that segment of time certain powers and potentialities of which the Exodus was an expression. But that reoccurs constantly in our own lives, to have Yetzias Mitzrayim. Okay, so it's important to differentiate between the statements that something is only a metaphor and the statement that it is a historical fact that has metaphoric value. That is absolutely valid, and indeed that is what Chazal do all the time, and certainly that's what Kabbalah does all the time, in which the physical realities that we experience are symbols of deeper cosmic truths that reoccur constantly throughout our lives, and that is what Yetzias Mitzrayim is. So, step number one is identify your Mitzrayim and seek liberation from it. Step number two is take your freedom and submit it to God's will. That is Matan Torah. You see, freedom, any type of freedom, whether it's emotional freedom, political freedom, freedom is not a purpose. In other words, when you ask a person, what is the purpose of your life? The purpose of your life cannot be to be free, because then the question is to be free to be what? To do what? Freedom at best is a necessary condition to be able to do something good with your life. But it can't be the content of your life itself. So that is why, after Yetzias Mitzrayim, freedom, physical, spiritual, there has to be a Matan Torah. You have to take your freedom. If I could quote, or not quote, but paraphrase, happened to be Jewish, although not religious, one of Sigmund Freud's Talmidim, Erich Fromm, he used to say that we make a big mistake when we define freedom as freedom from something. Freedom has to be freedom towards something. Freedom from... Sure, how long?
Till the quarter of one.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, there we go. Yeah, freedom is not just freedom from something. It has to be freedom towards something. That's exactly Matan Torah. Yetzias Mitzrayim is a journey towards something, towards Matan Torah. So you see this all the time. That is why, again, we're talking about the holidays, which are not here for a while, but these are the parshios, so I'm giving myself license to talk about the holidays connected to these parshios. Pesach and Shavuos. Now we know Pesach is the 15th of Nisan. But what date is Shavuos? So everybody's going to answer the 6th of Sivan, and that's 100% correct. But do you know that if you ask yourself what date does the Torah give for Shavuos? The Torah gives no date for Shavuos at all. Shavuos is defined as the 50th day of the counting of the Omer, which starts on Pesach. It happens to be, because of our calendar, that will always be the 6th of Sivan. But that's not inevitable. Before you had a fixed calendar, in the time of the Temple, you didn't have a fixed calendar, meaning a month could be... a lunar month can be 29 days or 30 days. In our present calendar, everything is preset. So it's always going to be the case. Nisan is 30 and Iyar is 29. So if you count to 50 days, the 50th of the Omer will always be the 6th of Sivan. But in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, all bets were off. Nisan and Iyar could both be 29. Or Nisan and Iyar could both be 30. Or, like our calendar, one could be 29, one is 30. Now, again, just trust me, but you can look at this, count days on a calendar and you'll see. If both months between Pesach and Shavuos, which is Nisan and Iyar, because Shavuos is the beginning of Sivan, if both of those months only have 29 days, then your 50th day will be two days later into Sivan, so Shavuos will be the 7th of Sivan. That'll be day 50. If both months are 30 days, so you've used up 2 days in Nisan and Iyar, then Shavuos will be the 5th of Sivan, because it's day 50. It is only if one is 30 and one is 29, and it makes no difference which one, like our calendar, Nisan is 30, Sivan is 29, day 50 will be the 6th. But the point is, that's almost accidental. Meaning to say, Shavuos does not have a date. Shavuos is defined as the 50th day of the Omer, which is another way of actually saying the 51st day of Pesach. In fact, some have said that the whole period between Pesach and Shavuos could be described as a long Chol HaMoed. It's like one long holiday. So if you tell your boss you don't work on Chol HaMoed, you could take quite a long vacation. Although you got to be careful about that. I remember when I was in law school, in law school there are big classes and they only give you tests at the end of the semester, so if you miss a class, nobody knows whatever it would be. So I decided to take off once from Rosh Hashanah till after Sukkot. So I figured I would do the reading and nobody would know the difference. But unbeknownst to me, this teacher started giving all sorts of written assignments that I was missing, like for a month in a row. So you got to be careful about taking off too many long vacations. But nevertheless, what is the significance that Shavuos doesn't have a calendar date? It is not a separate holiday. It is the end of Passover. Because Pesach is about freedom, and Shavuos is about submission to Hashem's Torah. And freedom without submission to Hashem is meaningless, and not only meaningless, but destructive and negative. And you see how the Torah is highlighting it? Shavuos does not have its own date. Shavuos is X number of days from Pesach. And it might be, you know, a number of dates. Freedom without responsibility. By the way, we see the same pattern in the Shabbos prayers. Again, I had mentioned some of this in the question and answer. You know, the theme of the Friday night Amida is creation. God creates. And the theme of Shabbos morning is giving of the Torah. Moshe brings down the Torah. Now, the Mefarshim explain that the imagery of Shabbos as creating connotes the idea that when Shabbos comes, you're reborn like a free person. The whole week you were enslaved and persecuted, and Shabbos you're liberated. You're like a newborn baby, free, liberated. But we immediately have to move to accepting the Torah, because freedom without responsibility is animalistic. In fact, Chazal make the point in another way. The Omer is a barley offering, right? A barley offering. And this is brought on the second day of Pesach. And it has a very important function. It's not stama mitzvah. All mitzvahs are important. But you know, there is a halacha that you're not allowed to eat the grain of, in Eretz Yisrael, you're not allowed to eat the grain of the new year until the Omer offering is brought on the second day of Pesach. You could not eat the new grain of the new harvest. Today, by the way, where we don't have the korban of the Omer, how are we allowed to eat the new grain? Which means, how do you eat grain? I mean, every grain is new at some point. The answer is that the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah explains that when there's no Omer, meaning we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, so we cannot bring the korban of the Omer, it is the passage of the day itself that matters the new grain. Which means, now what is the day that you bring the Omer? The day you bring the Omer is the second day of Pesach, which in Eretz Yisrael is already Chol HaMoed. That would be the 16th of Nisan. So when there's a Beis HaMikdash, you cannot eat the new grain until the Omer offering was brought on the 16th of Nisan. Bizman Hazeh, you cannot eat the new grain until the 16th of Nisan has passed. Now, that raises... Now, this halacha applies very much today. Again, because there are hashgachas, you don't have to worry about this so much. There are, you know, the rabbinical supervisions take care of it. But what that means is the following. The newly harvested grain... Let's say, for example, grain was harvested, it was planted and harvested in the summer. Now, if that was newly planted and harvested grain, that grain cannot be eaten till the second day of Pesach. Now, right after the second day of Pesach, there is no new grain. All the grain was old, because it was planted before the second day of Pesach. But essentially, the danger zone of the year is between Sukkos and Pesach. Because there you may have had grain that was planted after the Omer date and was harvested before the next Omer date. So that's called new grain that you can't eat until the Omer date passes. You understand the idea? In other words, new and old are relative, meaning old simply means grain that was planted before an Omer date. New means grain that was planted after an Omer date, which is the second day of Pesach. So any grain that was planted after the second day of Pesach, when it is harvested, cannot be eaten until the coming second day of Pesach. That's called the Isser of Chadash. And in the positive way, you only eat Yashan. Now again, as I say, you don't have to worry your heads about this in Eretz Yisrael, L'chol HaPachos, because everything that is sold under reliable rabbinical supervision will be Yashan, meaning in this time of the year it'll be pre-Pesach grain. But where there is a problem, I don't want to make life more complicated for you, is there's a huge, huge machlokes. This is a totally digression, not a digression, but I'm just mentioning it for your general edification. There is a huge machlokes, a poskim, whether the prohibition of chadash applies in chutz la'aretz. Now, mainstream hashgachos, like the OU and the like, they are lenient. So they will certify products that were made with the new grain because they rely on the Ramah, eminent poskim, who say there is no prohibition of chadash on the grain of chutz la'aretz. But many, many people are machmir to observe the laws of chadash even on chutz la'aretz grain. And as a result, out of Lakewood and other places, they print actual manuals where if you study product codes, you can actually determine when it was harvested and when it was planted, etc. And blood. Now, the good news is, though, all chadash eventually becomes yashan. So if I buy, spaghetti or cookies or bread, and I keep it, well, bread, okay. Of course, there's a problem with Pesach in the middle. You got to sell it to a guy, but assuming that it'll be around, it'll automatically become old as soon as, not just stale, but yashan, halachically yashan, afterwards. Okay, but this was a digression. Why am I bringing this up? I'm bringing this up just for the following reason. When there was a Beis HaMikdash, the korban that was brought on the second day of Pesach was a barley offering. Now, obviously, it wasn't chametz, because it's Pesach, right? It wasn't chametz, but it was a barley offering. Chazal say that barley was generally given to animals. It was not usually used in those days for human consumption. Then comes the holiday of Shavuos. On the holiday of Shavuos, we also bring a grain offering in the temple. But the grain offering is wheat bread. And Chazal points out, barley is animal fodder, and wheat is human food. And the lesson is, freedom without Torah is simply animal wildness, animal liberation. And it is only with Torah that it becomes human dignity. And that is why the korban on Shavuah, on Pesach, is animal food, and the korban of Shavuos is human food. Okay, this is such an important linkage that we think freedom is the ability to do whatever it is you want. Well, a very wise person once said, no, an animal does what it wants. Freedom is the ability to do what you don't want, and the ability not to do what you want to do. Because then you're free. You can say, although I would rather do this, but I know it's not the right thing, so I'm not going to do it. That's being free. That's an amazing thing. That in spite of the fact that it's easy for you, it's pleasant for you, you'd enjoy doing it, you'd have a nice time, but because of your moral sense and your duty to listen to Hashem, that's a free person. That's why people point out such an amazing thing sometimes, you know. People have said stories. They offer a 5-year-old a candy, and you know, real good candy. And the 5-year-old looks at his father and mother, or mother, and says, "Is this a kosher?" Quite amazing that a 5-year-old can have the self-control and the discipline to know that this is not the right thing to do. That's freedom. If you do whatever you want to do, that's not being free. You're simply a prisoner of your emotions, your urges, your lusts, your passions. Like, it's taken us over. That's not free. So it's a wise statement. It's not my statement, but it's a wise statement that true freedom is when you can do things you don't want to do and you don't do things you want to do. Then you're free because you're not controlled. And this is what Chazal mean when they say Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Ein ben chorin ela mi she'osek b'Torah. No one is free ben chorin, except the person who learns Torah. And although the direct reference is learning Torah, of course, but it also means, as a more general way, one who submits to the Torah is truly free, because they are above the passions and the drives and the instincts that take over a person and really take away their autonomy and take away their self-control. Right? And that is the freedom of living in accordance with the Torah. I mentioned before, Tagore was an Indian poet, not a Native American, meaning Asian Indian. And he was not Jewish. I don't know if he knew any Jews. But he once said a very beautiful... He was a poet, so he spoke in metaphors and the like. He once had a very, very beautiful description of a human soul. And he said, a human soul is like a violin string. There is beautiful music within the human soul. But imagine if you had a violin string that was totally free. Cut it off the violin, put it on the kitchen table. It's free, unencumbered, not tied down. What music can you get from something that's totally free? Nothing comes out. Paradoxically, in order for it to express the beauty that is within, it needs to be tied down. Now you might say, but that's unfair. That's limiting it. That's tying it down. That's taking away freedom. But no, it is precisely that submission that enables the beauty within. Now Tagore was not talking about Torah per se, but he was talking about the general idea, which of course is exactly what we're teaching, that it is submission to the will of Hashem that actually liberates you, opens you up, brings out your creativity, brings out your abilities, allows your soul to sing, to express the music that is within. This is why, once again, Shavuos does not have its own date. It is described as essentially the 51st day of Pesach through the counting of the Omer, because the Omer starts on day two, so it's the 51st day from the first day of Pesach, because it gives the meaning to freedom. Right? So these are the two steps. Identify your Mitzrayim and become liberated from your Mitzrayim, number one. Number two, use your freedom to submit yourself to God. That is Matan Torah. And then there's a third step that is the culmination of all of this, and that is make your life a tabernacle, a mishkan, for the glory of Hashem. Again, as I say, although we do not say the Torah is metaphorically true, the Torah is historically true, but the history itself is a metaphor for higher reality. And Mishkan is the same thing. The tabernacle in the desert, which of course became the temple in Jerusalem, right? The Mishkan was in the Midbar. Once we come to Eretz Israel, well, we actually had the Mishkan. We actually had a Mishkan for 300 years, even in Eretz Israel. That was in Shiloh. Eventually, the Mishkan in Shiloh was destroyed, but the ultimate temple, of course, is in Yerushalayim, and may it be built from Heira V'Yameinu. But the Mishkan itself is a metaphor for Hashem's presence dwelling within our heart and our soul. And this can be seen from the actual wording of the verse when the Jewish people were commanded to build a Mishkan. V'yasu li mikdash. Make for me, Hashem says, a Mishkan, a dwelling place. V'shachanti b'socham. So I will dwell in them. In them means the Jewish people. And Chazal point out, it does not say, v'shachanti b'tocho, I will dwell in it. That's what you would expect. Make for me a Mishkan, so I will dwell in it. That's not what it says. Make for me a Mishkan, so I will dwell in them. Them is us. In other words, the Mishkan is simply a reminder of the potentiality of God's presence dwelling within every one of us. And therefore, Shemos is an individual three-step plan for how we order our lives. Identify your slaveries and transcend them. Yetzias Mitzrayim. Submit yourself to God's will. That is Matan Torah. And then make your life a temple to the glory of Hashem, that Hashem's glory should be reflected through the way that we live our lives. Now that is a deeper level. That is deeper than keeping. I mean, keeping the Torah is wonderful, fantastic, and necessary. And halvai, 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 we would merit to keep the Torah. But there's a level above. There's a level above that. And the level above that is you don't simply keep the laws, as important as that is, but that every step of your life, you endeavor to bring glory to Hashem. Yeah.
Can you give some examples of what that third part looks like?
Well, again, if you look at the Mesilas Yesharim, you will actually look at the higher levels and you will see description. But essentially it means that everyone, I mean, these are very, very high levels, but everyone that encounters you walks away with the heightened feeling of the greatness of God by seeing the goodness within you, the kindness within you, the compassion, the way that you help people, and the like. In other words, God's glory is reflected off the way we behave towards others. So primarily, Bein Adam L'Chaveiro is a huge, huge component of how every action in your life is reflects the glory of Hashem. You know, I like, you know, here in our Sameach, we, not particularly me, but, you know, we have Rabbi Gottlieb, other teachers and like, I talk about it a little bit sometimes, people need proofs of the Torah, proofs of God, how do you refute evolution, you know, and we go through, not we, but, you know, the faculty of our Sameach goes through the scientific issues and the fallacies of science and the limitations of science and the fact that scientism sometimes becomes a religion in its own right. In other words, sometimes certain so-called scientific truths become as dogmatic, lahabdil, as the religious truths that they attack as being dogmatic. Right? And, you know, and obviously this is a discussion that is a useful and important discussion. But there's something outside of that discussion that I have always found very, very moving and heartwarming. That is Rabbi Saul Salanter, the great innovator of Musar and developing character and the like. He had many disciples, and one of his greatest disciples, perhaps his greatest disciple, was a man, Rav Simcha Zissel, who was called the Altar of Kelim, the Old Man of Kelim. And this is very, very interesting. I mean, this deserves a whole shiur on its own, which I think you would find very, very interesting. Maybe I'll save it for a later time. But I just want to bring out one thing. He lived during the decades when Darwin's work was being published. Darwin's work was published in the 1850s, 1860s, into the 1870s. Right? Darwin authored The Origin of Species, and this was the book that first articulated on some type of scientific basis theory of evolution. By the way, Darwin actually believed in God. Darwin was actually a very religious Christian. He was not a heretic or an apikoris, but nevertheless, he articulated theory of evolution. So Rav Simcha Zissel said the following statement. Darwin could teach that man came from ape only because he never met my Rebbe, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. If Darwin would have met Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, he would have known only God could have made such a person. Such a person could not rise from a mere animal. Now, as an intellectual argument, you know, you might find that a bit wanting. Rav Simcha Zissel didn't address the science, didn't address, you know, all of the evidence, didn't examine the fossils. But what he's teaching us is that there are truths in life that are deeper than those that we communicate with our minds sometimes, or that we understand with our mind. That is, sometimes holiness just hits you between the eyes. You meet a holy person and you feel it. And that is what I mean by making the name of God glorified. Somebody once said, this was a letter, somebody wrote to me a very critical letter, so actually it was a muster to me, but they used something as an example, which was quite striking. They knew a rabbi, actually his picture is in the office. There was a great rabbi who used to teach here sometimes, at least on a part-time basis, but he was a great gadol, Rav Simcha Wasserman. Maybe you heard of him. His father was a very, very famous gadol who died in the Holocaust, Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman. Rav Simcha Wasserman was his son. Very different personalities, by the way. It's quite amazing. Rav Yochanan Wasserman was a great, great gadol. He was the Chafetz Chaim's closest student and confidant. But Rav Yochanan was known to be an extremely serious person. Very, very serious. In fact, if his Talmidim saw him smile once, they would recount it. Do you remember when the Rebbe smiled 5 years ago? You know, it was like... He was just very, very serious. Very caring. I don't mean that, God forbid, he lacked compassion. No, he was very compassionate and loving and righteous. But he was serious. He did not... his son... maybe aptly named Simcha is happiness, was very jovial. It's very interesting, kind of the opposite of the way the father was described. And his son, Baruch Hashem, survived the Holocaust and taught Torah in many, many places, the West Coast, Detroit, and came the last decades of his life to Eretz Yisrael, and he was very involved in Or Sameach, in the early years of Or Sameach, with Simcha Wasserman and the like. And what somebody wrote to me about Rav Simcha Wasserman was this, that he was such a man that if the whole Torah would be forgotten from the world, we would be able to reconstruct it by just watching him for a day. Let's say we forgot the Torah. You know, watch him and you'll know it. Meaning every single movement was the Torah, every single thing he did. There was nothing he did that was not within the Torah. And therefore you could reconstruct the whole system of Judaism. That's what a truly righteous person whose every movement is the glory for God. Right? So it's hard to describe in a tangible sense, but it's one of those things, when you see it, you know it. By the way, one thing about Simcha Wasserman, I'll tell you an amazing little story about him. He and his Rebbetzin did not merit to have children. They had no children. He died before her. So she said she has no desire to live in the world without her husband. But such a man deserves someone to sit shiva for him. And she said, I'm the only mourner. So she shat 7 days of mourning for him. And I believe the morning of the eighth day, she died. She kind of willed herself to stay alive for 7 days of Shiva. And then she left the world. She died like 1 week after him. And they're obviously buried buried next to each other and the like. So this is kind of a righteousness that goes beyond, you know, being an Orthodox. Being an Orthodox Jew is a wonderful thing, but this is a different level, right? This is something that goes beyond what we think is the norm. Right, so really the book of Shmos, therefore, the bottom line is, the book of Shmos is a manual for spiritual perfection. Identify your mitzrayims and transcend them. Submit your will to the will of God, receiving the Torah, and then try to make your life a tabernacle for the glory of Hashem, so that everyone you meet will get a sense of that glory and want to be connected to it in one way or the other. Okay, so once again, therefore, what happens in the Torah is an eternal direction to us. Now, of course, the book of Shmos has many, many specific commandments. In other words, remember that unlike Genesis, the book of Bereishis, that only has three mitzvahs, right? Bereishis doesn't have a lot of commandments. Bereishis has three mitzvahs. What are the three? Be fruitful and multiply. Pru urvu. Try to have kids, right? Number two, the mitzvah of circumcision, bris milah. And number three, one negative commandment, not to eat from the sciatic nerve, right, the thigh, because that's where the angel smote Yaakov, and we remember that encounter by not eating. Only three mitzvahs in Bereishis. The book of Shmos has many, many commandments, and God willing, we'll talk about those commandments. But the point is, apart from the specific commandments, there is a general overarching theme in the book of Shmos about how to create a godly life. And these are the three steps that we need to be concerned with. Okay, but for these weeks, we are focusing on theme number one, Yetzias Mitzrayim. Now, let me just mention some interesting halachic points here. There are two mitzvos connected with remembering the Exodus. Now, I don't mean things like eating matzah, that for sure, but I'm talking about narrating the Exodus. Speaking about the Exodus. There are two commandments. One is an annual commandment, and the other is a daily commandment. The annual commandment is the night of the Seder. The night of the Seder, which is the night of the 15th of Nisan, we are commanded to recount the story of God taking us out of Egypt. And that is the basis of the Seder. That is why we recite what is called a Haggadah. Haggadah means narrative. Now, what is the source for the annual mitzvah of Haggadah? It is a verse that says, V'higadata levincha, that's why we use Haggadah, higadata, you shall tell your child. By Yom Ahu. Now, Yom doesn't mean day, it means the date. On that date, Vavorza Sashemli, because of all that God has done for me when He took me out of Egypt, we are observing these rituals. This is an annual mitzvah, because the Torah says, By Yom Ahu, on that day, which the Gemara Darshans refers to the night. Now, in Chutz Laaretz, because of calendrical doubt, etc., you have two seders, but as far as the Torah is concerned, this is an annual mitzvah to get together and recount the Exodus. Now, of course, you might argue, well, but the Torah says the mitzvah of Haggadah is only to tell your son, or tell your child, let's say. What if you're not married? What if you don't have children? What if your kids are away? What if you're by yourself? So the Gemara has a drasha. Don't worry about this. The Gemara has a drasha. Hopefully nobody's going to ever have to celebrate Pesach totally by themselves. But even if you're all by yourself, you have to recite the Haggadah. This is a mitzvah min HaTorah. It is a commandment to recite the Haggadah. Some Sifrei Chassidus say a thought that is similar, Lahavdil, to pop psychology, because they say, you shall tell your child, speak to the inner child within you, that every person has to also have a certain aspect of a child. So even if you're the only one that's there, you are the child. What does it mean to be a child? You're supposed to be an adult, right? So you don't, we're not supposed to be children all of our lives. But the Mefarshim say, in certain ways, we are supposed to be childlike. A child has wonder for the world. A child has a sense of amazement, a sense of excitement. A child is not jaded, not cynical, yet. These are qualities that one should have, even if you're old and learned and the like. Right? This is what we learn from our children. The great Hasidic Rebbe, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, you've heard of the Berdichev Rebbe? He was known for so many things. He always looked at every Jew favorably. Right? You know, the story goes, he once met a Jew smoking on Shabbos and said to the Jew, "Do you know that it's Shabbos today?" And the Jew says, "Yeah." "Do you know you're not allowed to smoke on Shabbos?" He said, "Yeah." So the Berdichever, "I'm doing it anyway." So the Berdichever said, "Look, God, look at your people Israel, how truthful they are. The rabbi of the town asks him, does he know he's not smoking Shabbos? And he doesn't want to lie. He loves the truth so much." Certainly you have to bring a salvation to the Jewish people who are so truthful and honest no matter what. Or there was another story that a wagon driver was greasing the wheels of his coach while he was wearing his talis and tefillin. Now that's very, very disrespectful. You're wearing your tefillin and you're on the ground in the mud and the oil, that's not covered. You take off your tefillin. But of course the Berdichever said, "HaKadosh Baruch Hu, look, they love your mitzvah so much that even when they are greasing the wheels of their wagon, they cannot separate themselves from your commandments." Or there was another time, the story moves in a different direction, but there was another time the Berdichever, it was time to start the Seder, and the Berdichever said, "We can't start until I call in a few people." So he called in the town smuggler. There used to be people who would smuggle items across borders and to evade taxes. And he said to the guy, "Tell me confidentially, do you have any contraband in your possession?" And the person thought the rabbi wanted to buy it or whatever it is. He said, "Oh, sure, rabbi, I have jewelry and I have clothing and I have, money, it's muksa, but, I have all of these things." And then he called in other people, a person who was known as a horse thief. And horse thieves were very serious. You can get, in Russia at the time, if you stole a horse, you could be shot, because the horse was a major asset. And he said, "Rabbi, I have 20 horses I stole this week, and he kept on calling in different ganavim, different thieves, different smugglers. And when he had a whole group of like 20, like lowlifes, thieves and smugglers and robbers, and they all showed off their stuff, because they thought the rabbi wanted to buy it. And then the rabbi said to them, 'Okay, can you bring me your bread?'" They said, "Rabbi, bread? Pesach? Chametz? Do you think we would have even a little bit of chametz?" The rabbi says, "I just want a crumb. Show me a crumb." He says, "Rabbi, a crumb of chametz? How could it be?" So he says, "Ribono shel Olam, the Tsar has armies, and the Tsar has executioners, and the Tsar has prisons. And these people don't care. They'll break every law in the books." Again, we're not giving halachic heksher for that, but they don't care about the Tsar's prisons, and the Tsar's guards, and the Tsar's executioners. And you, Hashem, in the world of free will, at least, you don't openly have executioners, right? I mean, Hashem made the world. I mean, there is, of course, an accountability in Olam Haba. But the way it works today, you're not going to drop dead if you ate chametz on Pesach. That's not the way Hashem operates the world. There's no executioner. There is no prison. There is no immediate fine. And yet their fear and reverence for you is so great that they'll steal 20 horses under the nose of the Tsar's policeman. But they will not have a crumb of chametz on Pesach. So the Berdichever was a great, great melamed zichus. Now, again, I'm digressing as I'm talking. The reason I mentioned the Berdichever is the Berdichever once said, there are three things we learn from our children. and you have to be a child in this way. Lesson number one, when you need something, you cry. The child cries. So too, when I need something, I should cry to Hashem. I shouldn't be ashamed. I should open my heart to cry to Hashem. Number two, when you fall down, you pick yourself up again. This is one of the most amazing things of children. If you've ever seen a baby learning how to walk, it is quite an amazing, astounding thing. The baby plops over and over and over and over again, and the baby struggles. And it's very excruciating. He says, you know, this grunting, you know. Now you figure, relax. Don't walk today. What is within the neshama of that child, in which he exerts himself almost superhuman? No matter how many times the child falls, we are hardwired to keep on going, not to give up. That when there are obstacles, as the Pasuk says in Mishlei, Sheva Yipol Tzadik, the Tzadik falls seven times and gets up again. What happens as we grow older? I don't know what happens, but I don't know why it happens, but what happens is we learn a concept called giving up. We learn a concept that, okay, I failed, forget about it. Child doesn't have that concept. So the B'ditchover says, if the first thing you learn for a child is when it hurts, you cry, the second thing you learn from a child is when you fall, you pick yourself up again. You don't give up. You keep going. And the tzaddik knows that, and we have to learn that as well. And we can look at a child and learn that from a child. And the third thing, which unfortunately may not be so true today, but it's interesting, is a child is never bored. There's always something interesting. Now, unfortunately, people have pointed out, actually psychologists have pointed out, that the notion of boredom is a fairly recent phenomenon. We're so used to the instant gratification of mass media, web surfing and the like, channel surfing, what do they say? 500 channels on cable TV and nothing to watch. That happens to be true. The fact is, nothing to watch. You know, but that is the phenomenon of boredom. So unfortunately, you know, modern society has maybe taken away that capacity. But at least 250 years ago, a kid was never bored. There was always something to see. And one should look at life in a very exciting way, that you see the beauty of things and you look at life with excitement and passion. So we learn from our children. On one hand, of course, parents have a great responsibility to teach their children, of course. But Hashem also gives us children so we can learn from them as well. And therefore, going back, right, the annual mitzvah, and I'll continue this because I said there was a daily mitzvah as well, which I'll talk about. But the annual mitzvah of remembering the Exodus, although it is described as telling your child, the Svarim HaKadoshim say it also refers to speaking to an inner child within you, as the B'ditchover explained. So I believe there was a series on PBS called The Inner Child or something. So I'm a little embarrassed when I say that because it sounds like a pipe psychology thing. But nevertheless, in point of fact, the Svarim say there is a phenomenon of remaining childlike. And I will tell you this. It is very, very fascinating. Unfortunately, it's very difficult today to get to spend time with a gadol. It's very hard because go to Reb Chaim Kineski or something, you know, you're lucky if you'll get 10 seconds. And the notion that you spend an hour with a gadol is very, very difficult. So the only solution I have for you, I only have one solution. You got to become the gadol, because if you want to spend time with the gadol, you know, you have to make yourself into that, and then you'll spend time with yourself, because it's very difficult to find another gadol who will spend time with you. But those who have spent some time with gadolim remark, and it's hard to understand this, it's hard to even explain it, but it very much is true. I've had a little bit of privilege years ago, and that is, there is something childlike about a gadol in terms of their excitement, their geschmack in life, and the like. I certainly saw this with Rav Moshe Feinstein, and with my Rosh Hashiva Rav Ritterman, with Yaakov Kamenetsky. There is an aspect that they're old, they're venerable, they're gedolim, they're great, great leaders who have the responsibilities of all of Am Yisrael on their shoulders, but they still retain the wonderment of a child at the same time. Something youthful about them. Actually youthful, that, you know, sometimes you feel that you're older than they are in some way, which is quite an amazing thing. It's difficult to explain, but it might be something that perhaps you've perceived it. Sometimes maybe you have a grandparent or an older person of who's wise and many, many perceptions. You will sometimes see that type of youthfulness that exists. Okay? So again, we'll continue with this tomorrow, and take care.
As soon as in the